Nuclear reparations. How can a country make up for having exposed large numbers of its residents to deadly radioactive fallout and contamination? The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, RECA as it is known, attempts to do just that by providing payment to those whose health has been negatively affected by the Trinity Atomic Blast in New Mexico, Manhattan Project legacy waste around the country, and radioactive contamination of land, water, and air by multiple aspects of the nuclear fuel chain. But RECA limited the areas where people were eligible for compensation, not including all of the affected states or all of the affected counties in an affected state, and it's about to expire in July. Activists and NGOs have been lobbying Congress to extend and expand RECA before that deadline, an exhausting, often thankless process. So when one activist was returning from a recent trip to educate Congress on why RECA is necessary, and just before boarding her plane home, she hears from her senator's office, and the senator himself tells her,
RECA is in the foreign aid package. It's getting put in. Not only that, he said, ladies, we're adding Alaska. We're adding Kentucky, and we are adding 50 zip codes from Tennessee around Oak Ridge.
Wow. Well, when Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL hears directly from Senator Josh Hawley, who has become a champion of RECA, that the bill to expand and extend it is now attached to a crucial funding bill that must be passed by Congress, your hopes rise that there can be help in getting out of at least one corner of that deadly, awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Dawn Chapman, one of the founders of Just Moms STL, who is straight out of the recent education and lobbying trip to Congress made by activists and downwinders from around the country. In fact, we spoke less than 10 hours after she returned from that RECA-related trip, so her energy and her excitement in this latest turn of events is fresh and undeniable. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, our new Nuke Watch report with John LaForge, and more honest nuclear information than was heard on the Super Bowl. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 13, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the Senate's border and Ukraine spending package contains more than $2 billion, $2.72 billion to be exact, in unspent grant funding for domestic uranium enrichment. Another $98 million would go to domestic isolation and production of isotopes to replace another major Russian export. Note that also attached to this funding bill is the Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act extension and expansion, which you will be hearing much more about during today's interview. Former President Trump, the likely GOP 2024 nominee, has called on Republicans to oppose it. Building on the information from last week's Nuclear Hot Seat interview with Vina Colley, Centrus Energy Corporation, the only United States producer of a special fuel called high-assay low-enriched uranium, or HALEU, has announced delays in its production schedule, casting a doubt on the nation's ambitions for nuclear independence, HALEU fuel is primarily produced by Russia, and we have been continuing to import this fuel from Russia. HALEU is the only fuel that could be used by the as-yet-not-yet-built small modular nuclear reactors. Not only has Centrus fallen behind on the ability to produce this fuel, but they lack readily available cylinders specifically designed for transporting and storing the fuel. The Pike County community in Ohio, neighboring the Piketon facility, harbors deep concerns about potential health risks associated with uranium enrichment. Last week's Nuclear Hot Seat, episode number 559, has an interview with Vina Colley, a longtime activist on this subject. Two Northern Arizona Native tribes this week condemned the start of operations at a uranium mine just south of the Grand Canyon. The Pinyon Plain Mine, located just south of Grand Canyon National Park, is owned by Energy Fuels Resources, a uranium producer based in Canada. A statement from the Havasupai Tribal Council read, "It is with heavy hearts that we must acknowledge that our greatest fear has come true." Pinyon Plain Mine, formerly known as Canyon Mine, sits directly above the only aquifer that provides drinking water for the entire Havasupai tribe, and they are concerned about its safety. Meanwhile, Navajo Nation President Bu Nigren said in a statement that mining remains opposed, quote, by all neighboring tribes that have forever called the Grand Canyon their home. The statement from the Havasupai tribe continued, "We have opposed uranium mining in and around our reservation and the Grand Canyon since time immemorial. We do this to protect our people, our land, our water, our past, our present, and our future." And yet, despite the historic and current assistance and advocacy from numerous allies and the countless letters, phone calls, and personal pleas, our urgent requests to stop this life-threatening action have been disregarded. A few tweeted messages from Ed Lyman, director of nuclear power safety with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He wrote, "There's no sugarcoating this one. A bad inspection report for the Salem nuclear plant in New Jersey contains 5 exclamation point violations associated with sloppy maintenance, containment inspection, and fire protection practices. Just what we want to see at a nuclear reactor." Then he wrote, "More problems in New Jersey. The Hope Creek nuclear plant reports to the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that it has discovered a programmatic vulnerability, failure, or degradation of its fitness for duty program that may permit undetected drug or alcohol use by personnel subject to the program." And then a bit of good news from Mark Z. Jacobson. He wrote, "Believe it or not, California's grid reached 117.8% of its energy from wind, water, and solar on Saturday, February 10th. That smashes the previous record set on January 7th of 2024. So for the second time this year, California has exceeded energy demands solely with genuine renewables. Nuclear was nowhere in the mix. Mega jewels and mega headlines are all nuclear mega nonsense, reports Linda Gunter on the latest so-called fusion breakthrough and other not-so-hot stories.
The week just passed was another typical one for our craven media, perpetual slaves to the easy soundbite. The joint European Taurus fusion project, also known as JET, announced that it had broken its own record in energy output during a last gasp attempt to make fusion work. The 40-year-old project is now closed down for good. The moment, and just a fleeting moment it truly was, lasting a mere 5.2 seconds, was duly celebrated as another breakthrough. Ran the headlines, "Nuclear fusion, new record brings dream of clean energy closer," trumpeted the BBC, who were especially smug since Taurus is based in the UK. "Nuclear fusion world record smashed in major achievement," said Science Alert. "Scientists have made a record-setting fusion energy breakthrough," blared the headline on Vice. What actually happened? JET generated 69 megajoules of energy in those 5.2 seconds, breaking its previous record of 59 megajoules over 5 seconds in 2021. For those of us who don't go about measuring things in megajoules, I defer to our colleague, physicist M.V. Ramana, for an explanation. What are they really talking about here, and is it actually a breakthrough? One can start with the annual average consumption of one U.S. household, Ramana said. That's about 10,500 kilowatt hours, which is equivalent to 37,800 megajoules. Essentially, using 1 hour equals 3,600 seconds, and 1 joule equals 1 watt second. Right, I said, hoping he would do the rest of the math. He did. The 69 megajoules generated by jet, Ramana explained, is equivalent to roughly 0.06% of the electricity consumed by an average US household. So, a minuscule contribution. But here's the catch. None of that was electricity. It was all heat. So what the jet fusion so-called breakthrough actually delivered was all hot air, literally. And now for some more hot air. First private nuclear reactor to power 2 million British homes, ran another headline. The private nuclear sector company in question is Westinghouse. Yes, that Westinghouse, the one whose executives are in jail over a failed new nuclear power plant project in South Carolina. The Westinghouse that went bankrupt, forcing its mega giant parent company, Toshiba, to shed it and all its nuclear assets to avoid going down with a Westinghouse ship. The same Westinghouse that is now $20 billion over budget at its other new nuclear project at Vogtle in Georgia. But the British press were all, oh joy, oh rapture, unforeseen over this announcement, a project that has about as much credibility as the whimsical plot of HMS Pinafore. And finally, this past week, we learned that Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer seeks another $150 million to restart the old and decrepit Palisades nuclear plant. Palisades has been closed for almost 2 years, and the company that would reopen and run it, Holtec, which specializes in decommissioning and radioactive waste management, has zero experience running a nuclear power plant. This latest ask comes on top of $150 million already approved last year for a Palisades restart and could be augmented by a $1.5 billion loan from the federal government as well. All of this nuclear nonsense is presented by the press as a promising answer to our climate crisis. But as the song goes in Pinafore, things are seldom what they seem. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
And on the website, we will link to an article from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists entitled, Congress Takes Aim at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's deja vu all over again. It's written by Victor Galinsky and shows how the nukesters want to take out safety considerations because they end up costing the industry too much money. So they're attacking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And we will also link to an oldie, still goodie, and really pertinent letter that nuclear engineer and head of Fairwinds Energy Education's Arne Gunderson wrote as an open letter to Bill Gates about his Wyoming nuclear reactor. Both will be up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 660. Also from thebulletin.org, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, an article on today's AI threat, more like nuclear winter than nuclear war. And it starts out, last May, hundreds of leading figures in AI research and development signed a one-sentence statement declaring that, quote, mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. While most of us worry about AI in connection with the launch of nuclear weapons, it has been suggested that a more productive way to approach AI is as a disruption to global systems that more closely resembles the uncertain and complex cascades of a nuclear winter. The article points out that artificial intelligence is already kicking off chains of widespread societal disruption. AI-powered disinformation sows distrust, social media algorithms increase polarization, and mass-produced synthetic media degrade democratic engagement while undermining our shared sense of reality. Meanwhile, the nuclear industry's favorite promo crank-out-the-propaganda machine, World Nuclear News, has let us know that the European Commission has launched an industrial alliance dedicated to small modular reactors, really small modular nuclear reactors, aiming to facilitate the development of SMNRs in Europe by the early 2030s. They are gearing up to shove small modular nuclear reactors down our throats, whether we want them or not. And so many of us do not. Here's John LaForge, co-director of NukeWatch, with our monthly NukeWatch report focusing on weapons, Europe, and politics.
Widespread fear of nuclear madness has been renewed by the war being waged in Ukraine between nuclear-armed Russia on one side and the arsenals of nuclear-armed NATO states arrayed against it on the other. The governments of France, Britain, and the United States all claim to be ready and willing to detonate their nukes against Russia under certain circumstances. Coincidentally, part of the peace movement has given the European Court of Human Rights, or ECHR, based in France, an opportunity to legally condemn the nuclear terrorism, which currently endangers all of Europe, and to strengthen the rule of law over the bomb's legal nihilism. Five nuclear weapons opponents, myself included, have submitted appeals to the ECHR asking for its review of German court rulings against us. We were all convicted of trespassing and fence damage following protest at Germany's NATO nuclear weapons base, Buchel, south of Cologne. As the highest court in the European Union, the ECHR hears cases from 41 states, but only after a defendant has exhausted all legal remedies in the country of the trial court. The ECHR has not yet said it will take up any of the four related anti-nuclear appeals, one of which was filed 17 months ago, although it has dismissed one appeal by defendant Susan Crane of California based on a technicality without ever addressing the merits. The anti-war defendants were all convicted in Germany after a July 2018 action involving 18 protesters who got inside the controversial NATO base, which keeps 15 U.S. hydrogen bombs ready for possible attacks on Russia, and which has been the target of nonviolent resistance for 25 years. The appeals rely generally on a three-part argument that has been dubbed the crime prevention defense, which is like citizen's arrest, and the further complaint that our expert witnesses should have been allowed to explain to the court and verify this defense argument. First, we argue that nuclear weapons attacks are illegal under all circumstances because treaty laws forbid indiscriminate destruction, attacks that are disproportionate, and weapons whose effects treacherously wound or harm neutral states or do long-term damage to the environment. Of course, nuclear attacks violate all of these rules. To illustrate, the Science and Global Security Program at Princeton University estimated in 2019 that even with a small number of nuclear detonations in Europe, there would be more than 90 million people dead and injured within the first few hours. This is because the USH bombs deployed in Buchel are from 3 to 11 times the force of the Hiroshima bomb that killed 140,000 people. Just one of these U.S. bombs could kill between 500,000 and 1.5 million people. All such mass destruction is forbidden by the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions, and other treaties. Secondly, because all nuclear weapons attacks would be criminal, it follows from the Nuremberg Charter and the Nuremberg Judgment that the planning or preparing of nuclear attacks is itself also illegal, a criminal conspiracy. This very planning and preparation is now underway at the U.S. Air Force Nuclear College's so-called Defense Nuclear Weapons School on Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany and six other campuses in the U.S. But under the Nuremberg Principles and Judgment, this Air Force planning and preparation of illegal warfare is itself a crime against peace. Created to prevent another Holocaust, the Nuremberg Judgment was imposed by the Allies against Germany in 1945. It was adopted unanimously by the United Nations in 1946, and it's recognized under the Charter of the United Nations World Court as international law. Nuremberg's international criminalization of allowing or ignoring state crimes is binding on all ordinary citizens, just as ordinary municipal law is binding on all of us. Thirdly, the appeals to the ECHR argue that because we are faced with government conduct that is so dangerously criminal and which threatens such extraordinarily catastrophic consequences, regular citizens have a right and a duty to nonviolently interfere with it. In view of the criminal conspiracy of planning and preparing a nuclear holocaust, the court must apply a Nuremberg judgment test, which bound personal responsibility to individual citizens and civilians, and which provided and provides now a legal privilege to act in the sense of crime prevention. We hope the European judges will agree that our government's ready willingness to commit mass destruction using nuclear weapons is a crime, and that the citizens who become aware of it, including the judges themselves, are duty-bound to take measured, effective, nonviolent action to help bring such crimes to an end. Stay tuned for the verdict by paying attention to this program. This is NukeWatch's John LaForge for Nuclear Hot Seat.
John LaForge will be providing an update on nuclear weapons and global politics, the NukeWatch Report, every month on Nuclear Hot Seat. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, another reminder that the International Uranium Film Festival is coming to the U.S. and Canada for 2 months of screenings now in 13 different cities, and we're talking with other cities to see if we can squeeze them in. I've covered the festival for many years and attended it multiple times. Each time, the trip and my involvement yielded a Nuclear Hot Seat special that focused not just on the films and their subject matter, but on local issues, activists, groups, what audience members have to say, and what it means to have the International Uranium Film Festival there as a focus for information and activism. Each of these episodes became lasting records of pivotal moments in local, state, and national nuclear issues. For this year's festival, I will be attending both the opening in Window Rock, New Mexico on March 7th and 8th, and the closing in Las Vegas, April 30th and May 1st. Each location will provide a different opportunity for me to get up close and personal with activists focused on uranium mining, nuclear testing, radioactive waste, weapons, and all the other nuclear issues, to provide you, the listeners, with a you-are-there soundscape of information and experience. But in order to do so, I need to raise the funds to cover my travel expenses, which are well over and above the show's monthly operating costs. So I'm reaching out to you for your help to get me there so I can report back to you. The good news is that Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your deduction is tax deductible. And we make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small. No amount is too large. So whatever you do, don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Just Moms STL, meaning St. Louis, was formed in 2014 by Dawn Chapman and Karen Nickel to raise awareness of the issues their community was facing from Manhattan Project nuclear waste and other hazardous materials at the Westlake Landfill in North St. Louis County, Missouri. When we spoke, Dawn had just returned to St. Louis after her third trip to the Capitol in 6 months, a whirlwind of 2 days to educate Congress members on the need for the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA. She joined other victims of radiation exposure from the Manhattan Project who live in Navajo Nation, Arizona, New Mexico, as well as representatives from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dawn was excited, sleep-deprived, and exhausted when we spoke, and we were just supposed to do a quick catch-up call and plan an interview. But she was so fresh with the excitement of what had happened, her energy so undeniable, that I had to capture it to share with all of you. So, without my usual interview preparation, what you are hearing is the process of discovery I went through, live and in real time, as I talked with Dawn to learn about what happened with Congress regarding education and lobbying on RECA, and what's ahead. We spoke just yesterday, February 12, 2024. Dawn Chapman,
I was thrilled to get your call this morning and had to interview you like fresh off the boat, right off the plane. Where have you just come from and what were you up to?
We got home super late last night. I think we got home at like 9:30 St. Louis time from a very quick 2-day Washington, D.C. trip for RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act.
What was the purpose? Why did this and how did this come up so quickly? And what was your goal?
So, you know, it came up quickly just because we know that in our world, that's how it happens, right? In the world of advocacy and activism, sometimes you have seconds to make a decision, and that's not fair, but it's how it is. You know, we wanted the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to be expanded and extended for all the communities that have historically been left out, of which there are so many, right, that have gone through the heartbreak of exposure from our nation's radioactive legacy, be it nuclear testing above ground, below ground, processing plants, nuclear waste exposure from where they stored it, which is, you know, across the United States. So we were not successful in getting that put on the National Defense Bill before the holidays. But that was but one of our many vehicles that we knew we had. And so what's happening is it's a new year. It's 2024, and we have some spending vehicles looming ahead of us that we can attach RECA to. But the other important thing that's happened, thanks to yourself and others who are carrying the story, is that other communities who have been exposed, you know, have found us, have started reaching out. And so the family tree is, we're connecting, right? We've been worried about each other. We've been wondering about each other, but we didn't know how to find each other. And miraculously, we're all finding each other.
It's like the line from the Nuclear Hot Seat theme, the activists are linking.
Yes. And we're so excited. Like, it's like, oh my gosh, there you are. And they're like, oh my gosh, there you are. And it's like, you know how emotional it is, right? Because when we find each other, when the activists link, we've been harmed. And it's both devastating because you're looking in a mirror. They're telling their story and it's really your story, right? And that's just, it's trauma. It's trauma. Yes. Mm-hmm. But what it is also is we are not alone. We are each other's best comfort. Nobody loves us like we love each other because nobody understands us like we understand each other. You know, we can look at each other and just tears can roll and you don't even need words.
So who were the people who pulled together and what was the impetus for this? What was the spark that pulled you all together to suddenly throw everything else you were doing up in the air and get yourself to Washington, D.C.
Senator Hawley's office reached out to the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we have a whole RECA. We have a whole group of people that we have, you know, a Zoom meeting. We're planning, we're talking, we're trying to figure out how to get this life-saving legislation put in place and expanded and extended. And so they said there might be an opportunity. Congress is crazy right now. It changes literally from second to second, but there may be an upcoming opportunity to educate some more lawmakers from states whose communities really should be added to this. We're having conversations, but they recognize that what really has to happen is the survivors have to talk to the survivors, right? That's what has to happen. The stories. And so we do that best. They recognize that. And so last minute, we were able to go, Karen and I, Kristen Camuso with the Missouri Coalition for the Environment was able to go through a grant that they wrote. And then the Navajo Nation was able to send some representatives. And then a wonderful man, Matthew, and I will get you his last name, was able to come from Arizona, who grew up in Arizona. And along with the Union of Concerned Scientists, we all just kind of linked, met. We had two state representatives, bipartisan. We had a Democrat state rep and a Republican state rep from the state of Missouri from different impacted areas and districts say, yep, we're together. Let's go. Hop a plane too. Because as you know, radiation doesn't care.
It's going to do what it's going to do. It doesn't care your politics, how much money you've got in your bank, what God you do or don't believe in. It just is going to cut through flesh. It's going to burn its way. It's going to create damage. And eventually, it will show up in a negative way in your life.
Absolutely. It will devastate your life. If it doesn't get you, it'll get a family member to the point where you wish it would have got you. I mean, that is the truth of it. And that is the survivor's guilt that every one of us lives with. And you know it better than anyone. It is true survivor's guilt that we face every time we have to look at somebody with a heartbreaking story. And it just breaks us.
Except they say we heal strongest in the place that has been broken. And I know without having been at Three Mile Island, I wouldn't have been producing Nuclear Hot Seat for all this time and having the opportunity to be of service in the way that I am. So let's get this back on the rails for the trip you just took. Who was it who put together the congressional side of it?
So the congressional side was put together by Senator Hawley's office with the help of Senator Lawn's office. What happened was they put forth a strategy. They knew they wanted to reintroduce the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, but they also knew that there was outreach from these other communities. Do we or do we not include them? Well, you know us. Hell yes. We don't leave anybody behind. Get them in here. Let's go. We're running with it. So the strategy was to reach out to those new representatives, right, and senators from impacted communities that were not previously included, who need to be, who we want to include, go there. The whole group was there, you know, the Navajo Nation. And the whole point, honestly, was for us to educate. We wanted to learn about their community's harm, and we wanted them to understand our community's harm. That was the strategy. Let's share our trauma. And it worked.
So how were these meetings set up and determined? Was this done through Senator Hawley's office, Senator Lujan's office?
No, with the help of the Union of Concerned Scientists, they helped us in the Navajo Nation because they have DC offices that are right there. So they got together, worked together to actually call the schedulers from these offices and set the appointments up to let them know that we would all be there. So thankfully, Karen and I didn't have to work on that. We said, we'll meet with whoever, whenever, and just set them up. And last minute, we didn't think we'd be able to get them, but we got the reps from Alaska. Yeah, because of the Amchica Islands, right? And because they're downwind of the above ground tests in Russia. And then we got Tennessee because of Oak Ridge and that whole community surrounding Oak Ridge. And then we said, oh, we're not forgetting our friends in Paducah, Kentucky, that whole community. So then we got representatives from those offices as well. And sometimes we went together and sometimes we split up if we had meetings simultaneous with other reps. As you point out, we do best, all of us that have been harmed, which is we just high five, hug, and okay, who's going where? Let's go. Let's do it. Godspeed. Bye. We'll meet back up. I mean, workhorses, just running.
How many meetings were there? How many offices did you and the others have an opportunity to meet with?
I think we counted a total of 10 formal meetings, 4 informal ones, meaning, oh God, there's not a conference room. Okay, cool. Can we have a little cubby in the, let's go in the hall. We'll just have a circle in the hall and talk about it. We got some pictures to show you. Love to hear from you. And then we amongst us, right, in the middle of that, where we could, we're coming back for strategy. Some, you know, meetings were being added on top of meetings because we said, hey, so look, just give us. There is enough of us here to break apart, to hit whatever you hand us. I would rather feel like there's too many and us hit them all and be exhausted than leave on that plane flight thinking that there was one that we weren't able to get. So every time we come back, there'd be, hey, 2:30 with the, yep, got it. Let's go. Who's going? Okay, you go. No, you sit there and go have a bottle of water and eat some crackers. You know, you get to do the next one, take a break. And in between there, as happens, the Senate, the second day that we were there yesterday, the Senate did not start till 12, till noon. So that whole morning became available. Just, you know. And we're like, yeah. But when the Senate starts, right, whenever the Senate starts up, all the media outside of the Senate rushes, right? Everybody's there. C-SPAN, New York Times, all the media just goes running. And so Senator Hawley looks at all of us. We're kind of having a bottle of water. And he's like, I got to go over for a vote. Y'all want to come? Let's go. Let's all walk together. So we did.
As you were doing this and making yourselves progressively more visible to more offices, more legislators, did word spread? And was there something of a groundswell of awareness that you were there?
Yes, more offices were eager to meet. You know, Gosser, Representative Gosser's office was my favorite. He's a member of the Freedom Caucus. He spent 45 minutes with us, and I had the feeling he would have liked to had another 2 hours, sharing his personal story, talking to us, learning about our sites. We had a representative of the Navajo Nation with us, learning about them. I felt heard. The Navajo Nation felt heard, but we also felt probably kind of how you feel in your role doing Nuclear Hot Seat, that we were able to hear him. When we were sitting with Gosser's office and his aide, we were sitting just in chairs in his office, right, in a circle. And he was looking at some pictures from our sites and pictures of people we've lost and that have been sick and whatnot, and just really asking about them and talking about them. And then it was our turn to listen, and he was sharing. And we all just, I think we could have sat there for 3 hours because we were all kind of healed. Does that make sense?
It sounds wonderful and appropriate and like a healing process that's available to the outside world that many of us have experienced has suddenly been extended into the halls of Congress, which is mind-blowing.
So yesterday morning, it was decided that we had a meeting with Senator Sullivan's office from Alaska. And since the Senate was not going to start till noon, it was just perfect timing. So we headed over there, and it was kind of one of the last minute meetings. It was just scheduled. We said, all right, let's go. I went myself along with Representative Tricia Burns from Missouri, and the Navajo Nation came. A representative came, as did the Union of Concerned Scientists and our new Downwinder friend from Arizona, Matthew. And when we got to the office, you know, we all had kind of our photos and whatnot. And as we sat down, I'm pretty good at this. I get emotional, but as we sit down around the table and we start talking, you know, and it's very obvious that we have a friend, right? That there's somebody on the other side willing to share and talk about their experience of the community. Our friend from the Navajo Nation opens this binder and pulls this photograph out, and I will email it to you. And I looked over, I was kind of mid-sentence with the Sullivan, you know, Senator Sullivan's rep. And I kind of just like looked down for a moment, and there was this photograph. I just froze for a minute, and just the tears. I just said, I am so sorry. I said, I just looked over at this photo, and I just sat back. I'm about to do it now. I just sat back and was like, I'm sorry. Give me a minute. And the rep reached across the table and just kind of looked down at the photograph.
Tell us what was in that photograph.
It was a photograph of some Navajo miners in a uranium mine with zero protection, just covered. And then there was a photograph on the top of two beautiful Navajo women who were purchasing a large piece of uranium. And there was a cash register there that they actually just sold it to them to put and to use to build ovens in their homes out of. And it just got me, because I think the question that we all ask, no matter where we were and how we were exposed, is how, why would they allow us if they knew we were being hurt? And when I saw that photograph, I thought, that's why. There can be no doubt that they knew at the time that photograph was taken that those Navajo miners were bringing that home to their kids and their families, and that they were going to die, and that it was horrific exposures. There can be no doubt that when they were selling that giant rock to those two women, that they knew that that was harmful, and they did it anyway. The United States government let that happen.
What was the response in the office of the Alaskan senator when they saw that photo and heard that story?
The same. He understood. And the Navajo representative kind of reached over and just kind of patted my arm for a minute. We just kind of locked eyes, you know, and I looked at him. And I had been with them for 2 days, you know, in and out of meetings. And I said, I don't know what to say. I said, I'm so sorry. I'm just sorry. And I think we use that, right? Somebody ran out and got me a Kleenex. And then I said, I apologize. I said, but you know what? I said, I got to tell you. I said, these meetings are really hard for us. I'm sure they're hard for you. I said, because we are forced to beg for our lives. The begging and what we have to go through forces us to relive trauma, things that were done to us that will never heal, that can't possibly be healed. I think it matters because at that point, we're not lobbyists. We are real people that have been hurt. You know, our message to Senator Sullivan's staff was, look, I don't know if you want to be part of this program or not. But as you can see, we care deeply about each other and about your community. And RECA will not be around come June. It will expire. The last thing we would want is for your community to wake up one day and want to be part of something that no longer exists.
A bam.
I said, I'm not going to convince you. I'm not going to lobby. I said, I'm going to share my story and why I need it. And you've got your stories of why your people need it, and it's up to you.
And Alaska has signed on?
Alaska is in this. But you know this, though. Every time you do a nuclear hot seat, I'm sure it's trauma for you. It's trauma.
It is actually the way I counterbalance my trauma, is that I have someplace to put the pain and the anger and the sense of betrayal, in addition to all the skills I've developed through my life in communicating, in service to what are those people thinking, and knock it off and then clean up your mess.
I think as we connect to, as the activists link together, that should be a shirt, by the way. We're linking together. Look, I don't want to hear any bull from the government that this stuff is safe. Don't come in here with the bull is also the message back to the industry and the government. We have all been harmed. And if this was safe, you wouldn't see what we're seeing. And they know better. What's happening today, I feel delighted because when I got on that plane, I was exhausted. But I kind of felt like I was flipping the bird a little bit to the government because I thought exactly what you have spent decades trying to not let happen is happening. And there's not a thing you can do about it.
Where is the bill now, and what has been the result of this trip so far?
As a result of the trip, the most amazing thing happened. We're getting on an airplane. I did my last check because I don't, you know, have Wi-Fi on the air. We're not paying for that. We can't afford it. I look down and the phone's ringing from Senator Hawley's office. So I put it on speaker and they said, RECA is in the foreign aid package. It's getting put in. Not only that, he said, ladies, we're adding Alaska. We're adding Kentucky, and we are adding 50 zip codes from Tennessee around Oak Ridge. It made it all worth it. We cried. We got hysterical. Yeah, I think I could have flown myself home. That's kind of how I felt. You know, because you never know. None of us has the resources the industry has. None of us has the resources the government has. So every attempt to educate is a financial drain. It's an emotional drain. And you never know. There's always this fear. What if we go and we get there and we don't do anything? And then a week later, an opportunity comes up that we absolutely have to take and we can't. What if we spend it all on this one and then there's another? We always worry about that. And so when we left, we thought, okay, we were exactly where we needed to be, when we needed to be there, with who we needed to be with. The universe just made it happen. And we met with everybody we needed to meet with. And then we walked together shoulder to shoulder and the press came to us.
So there has been coverage of this.
There's a Hill article out now. We will send you photographs from the press conference because we just decided you know, the Senator Hawley had to go walk over. The Senate was getting ready to start. So he needed to get over, get in there and do his votes. And he's like, well, let's just all go. Come on, let's just all walk. We can't go to into the Senate, but he can. So we basically escorted him over to the Senate.
So the RECA extension and expansion is now attached to the bill for foreign aid to Ukraine, is it?
I believe that there is foreign aid for Israel in there. I'm not certain, and maybe Taiwan. So the goal is, and the theory is, and the strategy for everybody right now is there are spending bills that this can be attached to. This isn't the only one, right? That absolutely must pass. The most important thing for RECA is that it go into a bill that has to pass. Because of the dysfunction, you could have standalone legislation sit there for 30 years. This needs to be something that's put on something else, right? And there are some pay for it if they're needed. But the important thing is that this foreign aid package to Ukraine, Israel, whatnot, that doesn't have a pay for it. So the message was really kind of cool. The message is, why are we making the poison people try and find a pay for it? Why are we doing that? This actually is its own pay for it. Helping the citizens of the United States that have been poisoned actually benefits our country. It's beneficial.
You also said that it was cost effective.
It is cost effective. And they know that. And actually, Senator Hawley said that. Said it's the price. This is the price for the defense of the nation. You can't spend money on one and forget about this. So it's a weird time. It feels very strange. There's unity. There's coalitions building. There's people linking. Sometimes the activist community can fight each other. The circular firing squad, you see that. That's not happening.
I think that you struck upon one very important point, and that is that nuclear is a unifier because it doesn't make any distinction based on anything. Molecules are going to shoot off neutrons like little bullets. They are going to go on a path. They're going to cut through whatever's in their pathway with the possible exception of lead. And if it happens to be a person, an organ, DNA, whatever, it's going to cut through. It doesn't care. So we all need to be unified on this, and we all need to be against any expansion of nuclear combined with cleaning up the mess that has already been there and taking care of the people who have been harmed.
You know, the interesting message that the nuclear industry puts out, and I'm going to tell you, this is why they're losing, and there's nothing they can do about it, is they want to say, we know how to do better. You can never say that when your old waste and the old things that you've done are still killing people and you haven't made them whole. And the reason is because mistakes happen. One thing that we know now as a society is that there is no such thing as absolute protection. You can't guarantee anything works 100%. And that the nuclear industry has not been able to make whole those it harmed from decades ago. And so there is no trust in anybody, even if they're for nuclear or against it. Nobody trusts them to be able to do the right thing should something happen tomorrow. And there's nothing they can do about it. It's just a fact. They can't fight it. They have created their own wall that is now closing in on them.
Well, hand me a brick and a trowel and I'll put another layer on it. What can we do? What should we and need we do right now to be part of this groundswell of support for RECA and support you and the others in the quest to get RECA passed in all its glory?
So the number one thing anyone can do if they want to help get RECA passed, even if you are living in a community that is not impacted, reach out to your legislators, your federal legislators, about how important this program is, because chances are you know someone, you love someone who has been impacted, because we don't just need the votes. from the communities that have legislators, that have folks that have been impacted. This is Congress. Everybody gets an opportunity to vote, and we need as many as we can to pass legislation. And the way you do that is just by educating. If you have a loved one who has a personal story, ask them first, but see if there's permission to tell. Stories matter. These people are not just dots on a map. They matter. Their lives have been devastated. So take that moment to share that, if they will allow you, with your elected officials.
Dawn, is there anything that you would like to say you haven't been able to get to wind this up?
I think that the cherry on top of this beautiful Sunday, exhausting chocolate Sunday ice cream, whatever you want to call it, that I woke up to was, when I went to bed last night, the last thing I thought about right before my eyes closed was, okay, we got communities included, but what we need is their voices. I bet they're just like us. I bet they've been looking and longing to be part, but they didn't know how, and they felt alone. And I woke up this morning, and Representative Chantel Nixon Clark represents the entire area along Coldwater Creek. Got an email this morning from a gentleman who lives in a community next to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, just looking for us, looking for help, feeling alone, wanting to be included in RECA. And she just immediately reached out to us and was like, oh my God. And my response to her, because there's this whole, what do you say? And I'm going to read to you what we decided, because this was at my heart. We said, we have been praying for you and worried about you for all these years. We have been trying to find you for so long, and now you have found us.
Beautiful. And I know he's only the first of a deluge of others who will join with you, and this will be passed.
That's what we want. My message on this, if I could, if you are listening to this and you know anyone who's been harmed at one of these facilities, even in Paducah or Oak Ridge or not, please reach out to Libby and find us. We are looking for you. We are worried about you. We love you. We just don't know how to get to you. Come to us. Get with Libby. Get with somebody Libby knows, and she will connect you to us. We are worried about you. We want you to be part of this. We need you.
What I will do is, on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, which is 660-660, I will have all the links that Dawn provides to be able to allow you to get in touch with her,
yes,
get in touch with her group, and move forward, because she is the organizing principal on this. I'm just conveying the information. So please go to the website, check it out, click on something, make contact, get involved, and get others around you involved, because a movement consists of people moving, and this is a great direction. Dawn, you and the others have paved the way on this, and it's a very exciting time. After all the difficulties that connected with RECA, going up and down and up and down, we've got it, we don't, it's there, it's not, it looks really positive this time. So you are tasked with staying in touch with me to let me know what's going on. And for now, again, brava for the work that everyone did. And thank you so much for making yourself available in a nano to be my guest on this week's Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL. The interview was so off the cuff and last minute that in the moment, Dawn went up on a few names. So I wish to acknowledge other members of the education and lobbying group she referred to. Rayon Francisco from Navajo Nation, Justin Ahasteen in the Navajo Nation's D.C. office, and Matthew Cappleby from Arizona. The RECA extension and expansion bill was successfully attached to the foreign aid to Ukraine legislation, which passed the Senate early this morning after a marathon session that lasted until 5:30 a.m. Now it goes to the Republican-led House. As you make your phone calls to your representatives urging their support, we will keep you informed. 2 points of clarification. While Dawn so generously volunteered me as a go-between for survivors looking to connect with her, it's best if you get directly in contact with her.
And to that end, I have put her contact information up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 660. If you or someone you know has information to share or was harmed by nuclear radiation in a way that makes them part of this story, go to the website, get Dawn's email. There are also listings for the Facebook pages and a website. It will be much quicker and more efficient and effective if you do it that way rather than trying to go through me. And the second point is, those snoring, growling noises in the background at about 11 minutes into the interview, that was Dawn's dog, a lab with a ball in its mouth, intent on play. Full comments from this dog will be part of my 13th anniversary show in June.
Activists, shout out.
The latest edition of Citizens Nuclear Information Center's newsletter, Nuke Info Tokyo, has been uploaded and we will link to it on our website. This is a major source for information about Japan that I share on this show. In this edition, they are going to be explaining the implications of the major earthquake that occurred on New Year's Day and several problems that occurred at the nearby Shika nuclear power plant, problems which could have escalated, and remind all of us of the danger of nuclear earthquake disasters. They also include the latest data on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant and a roundup of the nuclear situation in Japan with an eye towards what we might expect in 2024. Again, that's the Nuke Info Tokyo newsletter coming from the Citizens Nuclear Information Center. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 13, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy, and it makes certain that you don't ever miss out on a single episode. Sign up for it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, and the big yellow opt-in box. You really cannot miss it. In that box, put in your first name, an email address, and every week we will send you just one email that will contain a link and a short description of the show's contents. It could not be easier because we want you to stay informed. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby, Halevi, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program and the website. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat and Hardestry Communications, reminding you, the future depends on what you do today. Temple Grandin. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.